Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. We kick off this particular Thursday with yet another weird law from around the world. We're going to stick in the United Kingdom for this one, because it is quite a bizarre one. It is a relatively new law, fairly modern compared to some of the other ones that we have seen. Seems fairly logical, but gets a bit illogical as we keep going. It is illegal to use your mobile phone whilst driving your car in the UK. That seems to be fairly standard. That seems like it should be the same across the world, and that perhaps should be a universal law. However, this does create a unique problem in the UK. It would then mean that technically, if you happen to find yourself driving through a fast food drive-through, you would not then be allowed to use your mobile phone to pay for your meal, because technically that would mean you're using your mobile phone whilst driving. And this could potentially carry a fine of up to £200. Very interesting caveat in the law. I wonder if it is enforceable and how many people actually adhere to it. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, and on the show today we're going to be taking a look at the IDC's R8.5 billion bid for ArcelorMittal South Africa. We're going to speak to Emeritus Professor at Stellenbosch University, Professor Jan Havenhart, get a sense of whether or not the deal makes sense and what we should be looking at from a South African perspective, given that it is taxpayer money at the end of the day that would potentially be financing the transaction. We're also going to take a look at Standard Bank's latest insights through their Liberty business around South African graduates that hold the potential of R1 trillion of spending power in today's economy. We're going to get a sense of how they are spending their finances and what it is that seems to be driving some of their investment decisions. Then we've got a conversation with the team at Equities Property Fund Limited, taking a look at their 6 months update for the first 6 months of the year. We're going to get a sense of how that company started off the new financial year and what lies ahead for them. Then we have a conversation with the SAB Foundation around the work that they do through the social innovation and disability empowerment initiatives that they have in place, including the social innovation awards that are coming up from that perspective. And then because it is a Thursday, we've got a small business to speak to. We're going to be speaking to the founder and CEO of a business called Smartful. We're going to get a sense of what it is that they do in the township economy and how they add value.
I think the family needs a break. We've always wanted a holiday home. Maybe we should see what's out there. Imagine waking up to an ocean view in a beautiful villa.
With a big braai area and a spare room for when family visits. If it's on your mind, it's on ours. Partner with a wealth banker will connect you to a home loan with up to prime minus 1.5%. See money differently. Nedbank Private Wealth. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We kick off the show with a sense of how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by founder and managing partner at Herenia Capital Advisors, Pietri Redlinges, to take a look at market movements and see what you make of them. Marmalade, lovely to have you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. It seems as though we can't escape the profit-taking on the market side of things. Equity markets up one day, down the next day. The only thing that really makes sense there is the profit-taking, because risk sentiment hasn't really changed from day to day and markets are still trading at relatively all-time highs.
Well, good evening, firstly, and thank you for having me. And the context, I think everybody's looking for the top desperately, right? So if you look at the Aussie future today, down 1.2%. So this is the top 40 futures index, right? So we'll use that as our basis of comparison going forward. So down 1.2% today, but yesterday was up 1.73%. So still above where we were on Wednesday, right? So yes, okay, we are now 1.19% off of the all-time record high. But I mean, in comparison to how our market has been running compared to the US, particularly over the last 2 months, we've outperformed international markets by a long measure, right? Thank you to the gold price. I think if you look at gold as well, that's also a little softer. That's about 0.5% down on the day, $4,020 a fine ounce is where it's currently trading. And I think everybody kind of is, you know, oh, there's a red day. Is this the top? I mean, it might be, right? But one spring does not, This is the second time that I've messed that saying up. One swallow does not make a summer. So I think that, you know, markets are generally just big sentiment machines in the end of the day, right? And markets have run really, really very hard. And it looks to that point where it's looking like it's becoming a little too good to be true, right? I mean, I don't know about you, but I've never seen the market between the space of April and now, what are we looking at, 6 months, run 33,000 points? That is amazing, right? This is, again, the top 40 index we're talking about. It just, it has to breathe at some point, right? I mean, even the gold price was $2,600 in January. It's $4,020 right now. It's a massive, massive, massive move. You know, something else I think we'll touch on as well. Silver price is like doubled, right? It's 100% up. Is there more upside? I mean, maybe, potentially, probably. But does the market move in straight lines like this? Hardly ever, right? So a pullback is due. It is necessary. A 10% drop from here, you know, might scare the pajamas off of most people, but it's not actually the end of the world, right? Overall, the trend is up. We can debate, and this is something that we have debated in the past, what is the market telling us? We're seeing interest rates being cut into higher commodity prices and a weaker dollar. This is a recipe for disaster, right? But it's all about timing. I've been saying it's a recipe for disaster for the last year, and the market just keeps pushing up and pushing up and pushing up. And most likely, we probably see more interest rate cuts from the Fed later this year. We probably see more interest rate cuts from our local sort of reserve bank as well. And this probably pushes the market up more and more and more. At some point, weaker dollar, higher commodity prices leads to inflation. The road will get bumpy. Is it today? Is it tomorrow? I don't know. For now, we can't fight the trend, right? So if the market pulls back 10 or so percent from here, great. Is that a buying opportunity? More than likely. What I do want to say is this. Something that a lot of people are asking is, how do I get involved with gold? I feel this is not the first time today that I'm saying this. Every single year, the stock market offers you a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I mean, it sounds crazy, right? But a couple of years ago, oil was trading negative, and then it flew to, you know, above $80, and then it just went absolutely wild. That was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. A few times already, we've had Bitcoin do 10,000% in a short period of time. Those were once-in-a-lifetime opportunities. This year, it was gold and gold miners and platinum stocks and probably silver. And does platinum have upside still? I certainly think so. Do platinum stocks still have upside? I certainly think so. Does it mean you have to chase them now because you have FOMO, fear of missing out? Probably not a good idea. A little bit of patience will go a long way. Even if they go up another 10 or 20%, wait for a pullback, wait for an opportunity where you can take a high probability entry. Every year, the market will deliver an opportunity that will change everything. Don't chase the ones when the bus has already left the station.
It's very difficult not to do that, Pietri, when people get FOMO looking at the market and you think, I could have been in there. And then the market keeps running and you think, well, I could have been in there from the last time I said I could have been in there. Pietri, let's take a look at the Rand, holding its own against the major currencies, holding its own against the US dollar, which seems to be fighting its own internal squabbles and problems with the US shutdown there. But if we look at the Rand against the pound and against the euro, fighting back there below some key levels that we've been struggling to break through below. Clearly, there is a lot of momentum at the moment that is in the favor of the Rand, even if it hasn't been much to do with Rand factors or South African factors. But we still have things like that grey listing review coming up next week, in fact, if not the week after that. So in this month, we have that in the next 2 weeks. And that seemingly is filtering into the Rand already. Markets are starting to price in, hey, this could be a good time to be into the South African Rand.
Look, I think the grey listing thing will hopefully move the needle, right? Hopefully we get off the grey list. That would be great. What I do see, though, is that the Rand is currently at these like key long-term support levels. So if you look at the charts over the long term, and I mean like over the last sort of 4 or so years or in a post-COVID sort of time frame, I mean, if you go back to, where were we, 2022, July-ish, we were trading 1680 to the dollar, 1682 to the dollar. Well, not for the first time. March 2020 was the first time we broke through that. But that 1682 level became quite a significant support level. Well, let's say the zone between 1682 and 1720. That's a 40 cent range, but that has acted as a support and resistance range for some time. 2023, it was support. 2024, it was support. And now we're back in that zone. So this is a, call it a high probability zone for a reversal, right? So if you look at the big range, it's from 1682 to 1920 to the dollar, right? So you could probably take long positions here and look to sell them around 1920 if this range that we're in holds. If we can break down below 16 rand 82 to the dollar, then we've got a chance at sort of strengthening, maybe even as far as 15 rand to the dollar. So, you know, here's hoping that that's what happens. But if you're a short-term trader and you play the probabilities game, now's maybe the time to start betting against the rand, right? Again, you do this with a stop loss and risk management, and there are, you know, there will be levels which, once the market has broken below, that you would want to take the trade in the other direction and bet on a strengthening rand. But from a trading perspective, now is a very high probability entry to go for rand weakness. But again, you know, there are lots of fundamental things that can change the scope of what we see in the charts, right? If we get off the gray listing, that's great news. If the gold price continues to pump like it is, that's great news. If the US government shutdown doesn't get any better and the dollar keeps weakening, that's great news. This is all good for us locally to get a stronger rand, right? So, you know, pick your poison. Are you a fundamentalist? And do you think that the rand continues to strengthen here based on all these, you know, great fundamental catalysts, some of which haven't yet occurred? Or are you, you know, a technical trader and you think, there's a high probability long entry here. I'm going to take that with a stop loss. And if I'm wrong, I lose a bit of money. But if I'm right, you know, I'll make two or three times what I risked.
I think that's going to be an interesting conversation to be had. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, the fundamentalists are a little ahead of the technical traders this year with all the volatility that President Trump has introduced into the market. But we're going to have to leave this conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Pietri for those insights and for the time. Always lovely having you on the show. Please remember, folks, that was not financial advice from Pietri Riedlingace, although he does hold an asset management license and you can speak to him about that. Pietri Riedlingace, founder and managing partner at Herenia Capital Advisors, joining us to take a look at market movements and perhaps what market sentiment might be thinking.
At Anglo American, we mine more than minerals. We mine possibility and progress with purpose. For over a century, we have been part of South Africa's story, investing in our country's potential and unlocking opportunities together. This year alone, through our Kumba Iron Ore business, we've invested 25.9 billion rand into South Africa. This includes infrastructure development, education and healthcare, community upliftment, and more. Follow us on our social media channels, Anglo American South Africa, and join the conversation. Anglo American, mining potential, building beyond.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And we're taking a look at the IDC, the Industrial Development Corporation's interest in buying out ArcelorMittal South Africa from ArcelorMittal. That could potentially be an 8.5 billion rand transaction that taxpayers could fund some of that. We're going to take a look at this with Emeritus Professor at Stellenbosch University, Professor Jan Avanga. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Prof, lovely to have you on the show. Thank you so much for taking the time. Before we get into the numbers and the technicalities of such a transaction, let's perhaps look at the steel space. Relevant space, a fundamental space needed in the South African market. Steel is a strategic resource that we are then able to offer to the world, but also able to use to industrialize our economy.
Much more than a strategic resource. For me, any country that can produce its own steel and even export some is successful. For me, it was always a cornerstone of what we've done. And some of us, I'm a little bit older, tend to forget that the steel industry in South Africa, ISCOR, was a state-owned enterprise. It was privatized in 1989. It was hugely successful. I can't remember the exact numbers, but I think we got it up to about 6 million tons of steel. And over the years, we had the various steel plants closing down. Now, in a country like ours, if you talk about steel, we have 80% of the manganese reserves in the world is in South Africa. We have all the coal that we need in order to manufacture steel. We have all the iron ore that is required to manufacture it. We have the know-how. We have the factories. The only thing that we did have to import over time was hard coking coal. But it's a small input. For me, it's unimaginable to close this down. The country needs it. We are in the process now of a major refurbishing and, I would say, rehabilitation of our railway. I strongly believe that we're going to do the necessary restructuring that is required to fix our railway. I believe in what Transnet is doing, in what our Minister of Transport is doing. So soon we are going to use and need a huge amount of steel. And I have to tell you, thinking of importing all of that, it makes me cold. I don't want to run away if I hear that.
Yeah. Prof, I'm glad you brought up ISCOR, and I'm glad you mentioned that importing is not an option, because we've seen that when we move from a refining country to an importing country, the fuel price didn't work out in our favor. So there's no argument here that the steel sector is vital for what we're doing. I suppose the question then becomes is at what price point, at what valuation? You mentioned ISCOR, and when we initially privatized ISCOR to Mittal Steel at the time, we actually, as the government, paid for that privatization to take place. There was a payment made to Mittal Steel to purchase and to privatize ISCOR. Fast forward all the years later, we've gone from a peak valuation of around 116 billion rand on this South African steel business to a valuation of 1.3 billion rand. The question then is, if the market is valuing this at 1.3 billion rand, this business, why then is ArcelorMittal wanting 8 plus billion rand for it? And why then is the IDC being prepared to pay 8.5 billion rand for it? It seems a bit excessive.
I have two or three takes on that. The first one, I want to say, if I can turn myself a little bit more into a socialist, I would be willing. And I just want to say, what's the floor price for this? And you alluded to it when you talked about what happened in 1989. I would be willing to use the N word and say nationalize. So just take it. You know, that's for me is the floor price. It's just take it over. You know, and obviously that cannot be done like that. But for me, it just says my resolve in this that the steel industry has to continue. And I think if we reach a point where ArcelorMittal does not want to continue with this, then I think the price should be low. It should be really low. I cannot believe that we want to overpay for something that they don't want to use anymore. That for me, it doesn't make any sense. On the other hand, I am not privy to the finer details of this. And 8.5 billion for me does not sound that excessive if it comes with a guarantee that we'll have the expertise, we will have the resolve, we will have the support from ArcelorMittal to actually make this work and make sure that this factories, this steel mills of ours stays open. And I think as part of that, some of the others has to reopen. I live here on the West Coast. For more than a decade now, I often cycle past the Saldanha steel plant. And for me, it's unimaginable that it's closed down and or mothballed. So I think part of this deal should be reopening some of the plants that we've closed. And we really, really need to get this going. We need to find a deal that will make this work on both sides.
Prof, how do we find that middle ground? Because any private entity could quite easily come into this conversation and say, I'm just going to wait for the business to go into business rescue, pick it up for pennies on the dollar. We can still rehire back all the staff. Why then is the IDC and the government insistent on perhaps paying up to as much as 6 times for this? And I can't expect you to answer that because you're not involved in the transaction, as you mentioned. Is there some value that we are missing here that perhaps would justify paying a premium for a business that, as you said, ArcelorMittal themselves could not want?
I think there's massive value in this because I see the issues. You're right. I don't know the detail of the deal, but I can tell you what I think the issues are. And there's probably 4 or 5 big issues that hurt South Africa's steel industry. One is obviously import tariffs and the dumping of steel from other countries. Well, the government's got control over that. The government has ways and means of dealing with that. ArcelorMittal a little bit more valuable. Just think about it. If you can do something about dumping. Secondly, the input costs. and an input cost here. We're especially talking about electricity and transport. Both of those are busy being addressed by government. So once again, we're looking at something that if government can fix that, that will make the value of the steel mills better. The third one here is some management issues at ArcelorMittal. Now, I don't know the company. This is not when I talk about Transnet, companies like that I know is in detail, I know what's going on. All I know, I hear the stories and say there has been some management issues. Now, if government takes it over and can fix that, that will also increase the value of this. So there is something in me that say, if this is something that was supposed to be worth 100 billion rand, we now say it's worth 1 billion rand. What is it really worth? And I think this boils down to goodwill. It's as simple as that. It's goodwill. So what can this business become? And if I think about that, then it should be worth much more than 8.5 billion. So I can see that point.
Well, whatever the business could become would require a lot of additional investment beyond the purchase price, and one has to wonder whether or not that investment we have the ability to do after we pay for the transaction itself. I guess we'll leave the conversation on that note for the moment. We'll see how it unfolds and possibly circle back to it at a later date. But thank you so much to Emeritus Professor of Stellenbosch University, Prof. Jan Havenklaag, for joining us to take a look at the latest potential bid by the Industrial Development Corporation to buy out ArcelorMittal South Africa from ArcelorMittal.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by the Standard Bank Group. Liberty, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Standard Bank Group in partnership with the UCT Institute of Strategic Marketing, recently released quite an interesting report titled The First 100 Paychecks Report that looks at the challenges that graduates in South Africa in particular face in the working world and perhaps gives us some insights around how it is that they're navigating their spend as they receive these new incomes. I'm joined on the line by the lead research and insights specialist at Liberty, Zandile Makobo. Take a look at this and see what to make of it. Zandile, lovely to have you back on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. According to the report, 1 trillion rand in spending power sits between graduates that are aged between 30 and 39 in South Africa. What are they spending this money on?
So 1 trillion rand is equivalent to around 14% of South Africa's GDP. So you can just imagine the significance of this rather small group of people when you look at the whole. And what they're spending on is really interesting. So what we discovered with this piece of work is that the transition from university into a stable career does take a little bit longer than it used to. And, you know, I'm sure in families, those generational conversations always pop up. So we are seeing graduates staying a little bit longer at home, delaying things like marriage and having children, but in that time spending 1 trillion, it's on furthering their education, it's on trying to start businesses, it is also on things like upgrading themselves so that they are ready for a working world. So whether it be buying a car or upgrading their wardrobe, there's a lot of that self-investing that's happening during those years.
Now, Zandile, the report also highlights some very interesting changes that we are seeing in terms of behavioral patterns from graduates and how they are choosing to allocate their decisions and their money to things like investments and debt and, as you mentioned, their expenses. Can you give us some insights around how these shifts seem to be playing out?
So I think what's really interesting with this segment is that they begin their careers at a juncture. You know, they've gone through the recession of 2008. Later on, it's the COVID crisis. In between, it's this AI age. So there's a lot of disruption happening just in terms of them trying to get started. And that's contributing just in terms of how they do things. So what we've seen, this is a segment now that's much more apprehensive when it comes to acquiring credit. They are paying off credit much faster, more diligent with their credit when they do take it up. And it's very much not just about, you know, celebrating that they've graduated and spending money and splurging. There's a lot more cautiousness with this segment. They are aware that the world is changing and they need to be prepared. So it's either putting money in investments, delaying things like buying property, because, you know, you're going to take on this big debt. You're not sure if you're going to have the job in 2 years' time. So they're delaying some of those big ticket items when they can, and actually looking to save up instead when they are able to. So they'd rather take on a savings product than take on credit. And that's kind of just the ecosystem driving how they consume.
Zandile, you mentioned that part of the delays include going back and studying further. Are we saying that graduates are finding more value in additional qualifications as a worthwhile investment? I mean, these qualifications, I imagine, can't be a cheap exercise.
No, it's absolutely not a cheap exercise. And what we do see is that there's this strong correlation between one's background in terms of the financial home that they come from and success at university, where middle and upper income households tend to produce better graduate outcomes. But having finished school and having finished their qualifications, they've entered a working world which is really changing dramatically, where even the corporates are starting to question what they need and how much of it they need, right? So we've seen just from 2008, 2023, the graduate unemployment rate has increased from around 6% in 2008 to around 12% now. And so there's a built-in pressure for new graduates to really shine. And many are then taking the time to either go into postgrad studies sooner. So they'll begin a master's, they'll begin an honors a little bit sooner than what you might have seen a decade or two ago. But there's also that desire to take up other skills. So taking up soft skills, learning some side management here, but also diversifying their skills base. So if you've studied a BA and you're seeing now how AI is so important, you might take on a Python course to kind of make you more relevant for this market. So it's that kind of thing that's influencing that further study element.
Zandile, before I let you go, I want to take a look at something that many of the graduates that would have been part of these conversations might be feeling. And that's a lot of uncertainty and anxiety around how to make some of these decisions. From a business perspective, how do businesses then start to look at what it is that matters to graduates and provide them with the assurances and the certainties that they would then want stepping into the working world?
I think one of the key things that comes out of this work is the big difference between past generations and this generation. There was a sense of predictability about economies, the future, and career paths for those who graduated a decade or two ago. For the newer graduates, that's really changed quite dramatically. And with that is coming a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, a lot of worry about what might happen and what might not. And what we're seeing is that it is creating growing stress amongst young consumers, but also, you know, decision paralysis in some instances where people are not willing to commit. They are delaying forever to make important decisions for themselves, like buying a property and so on. And I think that's where business can play a significant role just in terms of responding to this. We are able just to provide a sense of direction just in terms of things like forecasts, in terms of macro expectations, what sectors are going to grow and which ones are not, but also providing the kind of products that will allow consumers to navigate more easily. So in the financial services space, the greater need for flexibility around certain accounts, a little bit of consideration around credit and interest rates for young people. All of those are some of the factors that will ease the journey for our young graduates.
Easing the journey and helping South African graduates make informed decisions about their futures if they weren't already doing so. That's where we're going to leave the conversation. Thank you so much to Zandile for those insights and for the time. Zandile Makoba, Lead Research and Insights Specialist at Liberty, joining us to take a look at the first 100 paychecks report that was recently put out by UCT Liberty Institute of Strategic Marketing. This feature was brought to you by the Standard Bank Group.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best forex rates around, As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Equites Property Fund, the real estate investment trust listed on the JSE, released their interim results for the 6 months ended 31 August 2025, the first 6 months of their new financial year. The business is on a stronger footing with a loan-to-value ratio below the industry standard of 40%, sitting around 37.2%. We're going to be taking a look at the performance of the business and getting a sense of how the business is faring with the company's chief financial officer, Leila Razak. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of the business these 6 months. Leila, lovely to have you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. A decent start to the first 6 months of the year, even through what many might consider a somewhat challenging environment. We're expecting things like interest rates to come down and start affecting the returns that real estate investment trusts are able to realize. But there are other factors at play in the property space. How do you reflect on your first 6 months?
Thank you, Jimmy. I mean, as you said, it's been quite a challenging period the last 6 months, but not only the last 6 months. I think the last 2 years have been quite challenging for us as a business and for a number of other property counters. Like you say, we've been waiting for interest rates to come down. They haven't necessarily come down as aggressively as we have thought. But despite this backdrop, we're very pleased with the results that we've produced. Our distribution per share has grown, and that's sort of the most important metric that investors look at. And very importantly, we've shown distribution growth, and we're guiding to show full-year distribution growth of between 5 and 7%. So for us, despite everything else that's been happening in the background, we're very, very pleased with our results for these 6 months.
Leila, the business operates a portfolio in South Africa, but also has a portfolio in the United Kingdom. Take me through just how you're finding the two environments. Are they performing the same? Are you finding perhaps some challenges that might be isolated to one market and not necessarily presenting in another market? Or are you kind of seeing that some of the global factors are affecting both?
Yeah, I think for the first time, what we're really seeing is a divergence between South Africa and the UK. And we're seeing far more challenging business conditions in the UK right now. And I think what makes it more challenging for a South African investor is the fact that we have a higher cost of capital, which we'd like to deploy into a jurisdiction which is supposed to be lower risk, but may not be fully compensating us for the returns that South African shareholders demand or expect. So throughout our results and through the pre-close period, we have been saying to investors, look, we are exploring the potential of actually disposing the majority of our UK portfolio. And that's a process which we're actively pursuing right now. So looking at potentially disposing that UK portfolio and then focusing on growth ambitions in South Africa.
Leila, what do growth ambitions in South Africa look like? The South African property market has kind of little nodes that are performing exceptionally well, but we are seeing other nodes that previously might have struggled potentially starting to recover.
Yes, so that's exactly where we see ourselves. Because our focus is on top quality logistics assets, what we call A-grade logistics facilities, and our focus is really on the top end of the market, so tenants like ShopRite and TFG and DSV, what we find is that there is a large amount of demand coming from these tenants. So if we focus on that top end of the market, because retailers are looking to optimize supply chains, we're still looking at third-party logistics providers who are being required to invest in infrastructure so they can deliver online or e-commerce sales, we're seeing massive demand for the type of asset class that we operate in. So for us, we really do see this as a time for us to take advantage of this demand. I mean, within the sector and the subsector that we operate in, we're seeing low vacancy rates of just around 1.9%. So given that constraint on supply as well as the demand coming through, we believe that this is the perfect time for us to expand in South Africa.
Leila, when real estate investment trusts look to expand on portfolios or even make different portfolio decisions, such as the disposals that we saw you guys put through in this first 6 months, it allows a business to not only reflect on where you are at the moment, but also to reposition your balance sheet, because for a business that operates in your industry, long-term investments and long-term assets are pretty much what you deal in. And so I suppose these restructures don't happen very often. Is this kind of direction and trajectory something that would then mean that some acquisitions and some other transactions might be off the table until this is over? Or is it just going to be a part of an overall restructure to say, perhaps this is the new direction that we're moving in and this is how we're going to go about it?
So I think it's a combination. The first is, about 2 years ago, we embarked on what we call the strategic disposal program, where we really looked at our entire portfolio. Our LTV was creeping up. It was above that 40% that you mentioned earlier. And we looked at the entire portfolio and said, which assets are we looking to strategically dispose of? Assets that may potentially be too small for us, assets which weren't particularly ESG compliant, or assets which weren't situated in one of our logistics parks. And so we embarked on quite an aggressive disposal program. And now what we're seeing is we're coming out of that aggressive disposal program, and we're really looking at now building scale in terms of what we would call modern logistics facilities. So either looking at acquiring these types of facilities or developing these types of modern logistics facilities. So really just improving the overall quality of our portfolio through recycling out of some of the older properties and investing into brand new ESG compliant state-of-the-art logistics facilities.
Speaking of ESG, Leila, the business currently has a solar capacity of around 27 megawatts. Is there a plan to increase that? Is that part of the shift and the focus to say, yes, we are greenifying our properties, but perhaps even the new things or the new acquisitions we look for are going to have to meet some of those requirements upfront?
Yes, absolutely. So we're looking at adding another 5.1 megawatts to the portfolio over the next 2 to 3 years. That's coming from developments which we have earmarked or from existing properties where we are looking to retrofit them. And then when we do look to acquire new properties or develop new properties, all of them have to meet our ESG requirements in terms of both solar, and we look at water treatment facilities or water treatment options at those facilities, and then just reduction in carbon emissions as a result of developing and operating those buildings. So ESG is very much in our DNA, and it's part of what we look at when we make any acquisition decisions.
An interesting 6 months lies ahead for the team at Equites Property Fund. They are looking to potentially rethink how they're approaching their property portfolio, but what is very clear is that ESG and greener projects will remain in focus. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Leila Razak, the Chief Financial Officer of Equites, for joining us to give us a sense of their first 6 months.
That's the sound of your business growing. Whether you're starting out or scaling up, turn your passion into profit with Capitec Business Banking. Save up to 50% on fees. Get fast credit approvals, personalized support, and Forex for your business. Open your business banking account on our app. Bank on better with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP. 46669. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This interview is brought to you by SAB. 130 years of being committed to South Africa. As we continue to celebrate 130 years of South African breweries in South Africa, we are also celebrating a unique milestone for the South African Breweries Foundation. They are marking 10 years of their Social Innovation and Disability Empowerment Awards, and we're going to be taking a look at this with the Executive Director at the SAB Foundation, that's Sarah Mtinso. She joins me on the line now to see what we can expect from the awards this year. Sarah, lovely to have you on the show. Thank you so much for taking the time. Let's start with a bit of an overview around the awards. Why has SAB, and particularly the SAB Foundation, been championing these awards for the last decade?
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for having me on your program. So the Social Innovation and Disability Empowerment Awards are a critical step in our entire SAB Foundation program. We support entrepreneurs that do a whole lot of great things for South Africa, one of which is supporting entrepreneurs that look at societal challenges and figuring out through innovation how to solve some of those social challenges. And we believe that when you identify as a company like the SAB, and obviously through the foundation, you then have to figure out how you assist them insofar as taking their ideas from ideation down to scaling their businesses. So we've been on the journey with a whole number of entrepreneurs. We've supported and we've seen many successes.
Sarah, these awards have, I would imagine, gone through a lot of different phases over the last 10 years and have affected a lot of people's lives. Can you perhaps just take us through some of the transformations that you've been able to help bring to life here and kind of where that leaves the awards today?
Sure. I mean, we started many years ago by identifying a number of individuals that really wanted to make a change in South Africa. And over time, we've seen remarkable transformation. We've seen a number of these entrepreneurs moving from just wanting to survive to ideally becoming innovators and driving inclusion insofar as bringing about solutions that seek to deal with real South African challenges that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. We've seen an increase in the number of women and young people coming through. We've also seen a number of people with living with disabilities also coming up with innovative solutions that not only impact that segment of the population, but broadly speaking, solutions that touch on. So a number of those that we have supported have really, really come up with innovative solutions. I really want to just talk about one example of the many that we've seen. We have in the past years, I think it was in 2021, supported a company that started very small. They call themselves Below Box. And this company, essentially what it does is that it has identified the very real problems we experience in public health facilities where you have to queue for hours and hours to get your medication. And essentially they've come up with what they call an innovative digital solutions where you don't have to go to the hospital to collect your medication, but you can actually go to a dedicated facility, whether it's at a mall, where you can literally log in and collect your medication. We are seeing a whole lot of those coming up to solve real societal problems and easing the pressure on our public facilities.
Sarah, a lot of the finalists that come through these awards are businesses and individuals that innovate in key areas. A lot of these innovations benefit women, youth, persons with disabilities. How does the foundation then use a platform like these awards and the companies like the ones you're mentioning to ensure that these areas or these groups of people continue to remain in focus?
And I'm glad you're asking the question, because right from inception as the foundation, we've been very purposeful about dealing with what we consider to be structural exclusions. So our focus is really around women, youth, rural entrepreneurs, and people with disabilities. And I think we do so because we recognize that very often these individuals that are excluded by mainstream facilities, whether you think about how banks fund, how mainstream funding institutions fund, they tend to exclude because ordinarily these do not necessarily meet those stringent criteria that are put upon by those institutions. So we're very, very deliberate in the way we configure our programs we support. We want to build those enterprises that are both led by and deliver solutions for these types of groups. So ours is really very deliberate. Inclusion is really at the heart of what we do. And we've seen a lot of great businesses coming out of those groups that would ordinarily have been excluded.
Sarah, you bring up support again, and I want to get a sense of what it is that the foundation then does from a support perspective. Obviously, with awards like this and from what SAB has done, there's financial support that comes with it. But the foundation has been very deliberate that it doesn't just end there. It goes beyond the financial support. How do you support the winners and those that participate in these initiatives? And just in general, how does that fit into the foundation's commitment towards ensuring that we continue to see this spill over into the communities?
Yeah, so I think over time we have learned that our entrepreneurs don't only need funding, they actually need that sense of belief, guidance, and network. So our support to them is very ecosystems driven. We offer over and above funding real value. So, and I'll list just a few things that we do. So we connect them with mentors and coaches that spend a dedicated amount of time reviewing and guiding them through their business models, individuals, looking at their value propositions, asking and helping them understand how to target their markets and refining and strengthening their operations. We also go as far as making sure that we build a network of like-minded entrepreneurs and partners so that they can support and continue to strengthen each other. In recent times, we've also introduced a mental health program, because just like society speaks about mental health, we also consider mental health in the context of entrepreneurs. So we've got a service provider who does a whole lot of mental health initiatives that are strictly driven to support individuals in the entrepreneurship space to build resilience, grit, and those kinds of things. And I think recently what we've also done is we've looked to partner with critical partners like the DTIC to really look at how do we then help them export their products that they develop locally to other markets, be it within and or outside South Africa.
A foundation focused on the communities that they serve and focused on uplifting those that are innovating and empowering those communities. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Sarah for the time and for those insights. Sarah Mtinso, Executive Director at the SAB Foundation.
This interview was brought to you by SAB, 130 years of being committed to South Africa.
Commitment is not just brewing beer, it's brewing hope. It's brewing dreams.
It's brewing a legacy. For over a century, believing in something bigger. Commitment is brewing a promise to step up when the nation calls, to brew moments that matter, that bring us together. For you, for the next generation, for 130 years and forever. SAB, forever committed to a future with more cheers.
South Africa, be sharp, not for persons under the age of 18.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
SME of the Week is powered by Capitec Business Banking. Start out or scale up with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply. It's SME of the Week time, and we are taking a look at yet another small business in South Africa that's doing really well for themselves. This week's small business is a company called Smartfill, joined on the line by the company's Chief Executive Officer, Navil Haras, to see what we make of this new business and what it is that they have to offer. Navil, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about Smartfill. What is it that you guys do?
Great. So Smartfill is a startup focused on delivering food and basic necessities at a low cost to low-income consumers in informal stores like spas or shops. We help consumers buy food more affordably. We help small store owners, informal businesses make more money, and we help brands reach these markets more effectively. And most importantly, while we're doing all of this, is we get rid of plastic. So the secret to this, the whole business came out of the question of, why does it cost so much more to buy things in a small quantity, like a gram of rice is more expensive in a 250 or 500 gram packet versus a 10 kilogram bag? And when we looked at this, we thought, oh, maybe there's lots of greed and people are just pricing a lot more for poor people, you know, overcharging. But actually the truth is logistics and the cost of packaging really push up the costs in those small packet sizes. And by getting rid of that and eliminating it, we can really drop the price for consumers every day and get rid of plastic. So it's a two-for-one.
So Navil, what does Smartfill offer and how do you go about doing that?
So Smartfill's business model is really to work with spas or shop owners. We are currently in obviously South Africa. We've got a small presence starting out in Zambia. We are in Kenya, small presence, and in Bangladesh. And our entire approach is to work with the small store owner to give them these smart dispensers, which are almost like an ATM, if you can imagine it. So it's a very simple, small-sized machine that goes in the store. Consumers walk up to it. They say they want, you know, 5 rand of rice, and it weighs and measures out 5 rands worth of rice and delivers it to them in any container they want, or even a paper bag or anything that they want to take it home in. So they're bringing their own containers. And the business model is really simple. We actually place it in the spas or shops for free. We bulk up all the different spas or shops we work in. So we kind of aggregate their volume, giving us a slightly better margin. And then we also work with brands who advertise on the dispensers. So then this dispenser is, for example, a, you know, Be Well dispenser, as an example, or a Unilever dispenser, and then they get to reach the market more effectively and thereby drive up their market share.
Naval, you mentioned Unilever. I know that this business was born from a very interesting program that you were part of through Unilever and the support that they offered you. Take us through just that journey and perhaps what that has been able to do for the business.
Definitely, yes. So we started the business actually as a partnership between DYDX and Smollan. Smollan is a big partner of Unilever globally. Smollan has about 80,000 people who do the shelf packing and management of Unilever and other brands as in-store, you know, supplies and packaging. And through that, we started working with Unilever quite a lot, and we found out about a program called Transform. And Transform is actually a program between the UK government, Unilever, and Ernst & Young, where they focus on businesses which have the opportunity to be sustainable, in other words, both good for the planet and good for people. And then they provide funding to help those businesses grow effectively. We've been working with them for a while now, initially in Bangladesh, where we were one of the suppliers to build out the U Refill program, which is a way for them to sell shampoos and conditioners and soaps without needing small sachet packaging, which is how it's sold in Southeast Asia in small little 6-milliliter packets. Now it just comes out of a single refill machine. And now we've expanded that project to take on the dry food that we do. So in other words, rice, maize meal, sugar, you know, a whole range of different things, and be able to deliver that to consumers as well. So that program has really helped fund us and helped us build out our market presence.
Naval, you mentioned that you are focused on the township market in South Africa in particular. Can you give us a sense of where people can find these smart or these connected dispensers that you guys have put in place and where people can find these smart dispensers?
Sure. So our first market is actually Tembisa. That's where we're focusing our energy. We want to get as many stores running Smartfill dispensers in Tembisa as possible to create a high density logistics network and to also get people to know about the dispensers and how to use them and how to interact with them. So to really make it a very normal way of purchasing items. The whole range of spaza shops in Tembisa will be going up to about 8 spazas, all there, and obviously expanding from there afterwards. And we've got about 6 dispensers per spaza right now, and our aim is to grow to up to 10 per spaza.
Naval, if I am a small business owner or I have a network of small businesses and I'm looking to put these dispensers in my small businesses, how do I reach out to the Smartfill team?
Sure. You can email us at either myself, N-E-V-O, Naval, at smartfill.store, or you can email Mark, which is maybe an easier name, M-A-R-C, at smartfill.store. And we'll definitely get back to you and work with you to see if it's the right store profile and if we can assist you. As I said, currently we're really focusing on Tembisa. We really want to crack that, and that's going to be the next kind of 3 to 6 month focus for us. But we're looking to expand very rapidly afterwards to grow both with brands coming on board. So currently we have Millie King, we have Be Well, we have Unilever and a couple other brands there too. And then the idea is to add more and more brands and to actually create an environment where people can go to a spaza store and buy a range of products in this method.
Naval, from the implementation that you've done so far in South Africa, how have you been seeing the reception of the Smartfill dispensers?
It's been really positive. What surprised us is the number of sales we do per day through the dispensers. We see 60 as an average number of sales per day. And most interestingly, the average transaction size is about 12 rand. So consumers are really using it to buy small quantities. It's really helping them with that kind of middle of the month challenge that they may have, you know, financially. And it's really helping solve the challenges the South Africans face.
A small business with a unique approach to consumer goods, a business that has carved out a new market for itself and looks to roll out that market, not just in South Africa, but in other areas as well. We wish you the best of luck, Naval, to you and to your team. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Naval Haras, the CEO of Smartfill, joining us for this week's SME. Inspired by the SME of the week? Start your own business or scale up and save up to 50% on fees with Capitec,
the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply.
That's the sound of your business growing. Whether you're starting out or scaling up, turn your passion into profit with Capitec Business Banking. Save up to 50% on fees. Get fast credit approvals, personalized support, and Forex for your business. Open your business banking account on our app. Bank on better with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, 46669. T's and C's apply.
It's exactly 7 o'clock. Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. So from my side, good night.